It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The novel Life and Adventures of Jack Ingle has just been published by the University of Iowa Press. The author of the novel has been dead since 1892. This novel by the iconic poet Walt Whitman was serialized in a newspaper in 1852 and pretty much hasn't been seen since, until now. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Zachary Turpin, who is the man who discovered this literary treasure. With me right now is Ed Folsom. He's editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review, and he's also the Roy J. Carver Professor of English at the University of Iowa. Ed, hello.
Hi, Gerardy.
Thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, we're going to talk to Zach in a moment about discovering Zachary Turpin, about discovering this novel. But I know that you found out about it pretty shortly after he discovered the novel.
Tell me about
that phone call.
I had worked with Zach the year before when he had discovered another Whitman book, Manly Health and Training, a series of Whitman journalistic articles that were published in 1858 under a pseudonym. And he had contacted me about that, and we had published it in the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review. So I'd worked with Zach before, and he contacted me last summer, and he said, I think I may have something even more amazing than Manly Health and Training. But he said, I won't tell you about it until I've confirmed it. And over the next few weeks, I would get cryptic messages from Zach, and finally, he said, well, I think I've found the novel, Jack Ingle. And so I'll let Zach tell the story of the discovery. But for me, what began at that point was a really interesting process of trying, on one hand, to keep the discovery secret, and on the other hand, to let the people who had to know about it so that we could move forward. Unlike with Manly Health, we added a complication this time around because we decided it would be really nice if we could have a book version of the novel available at the time the publicity came out. So we worked with Jim McCoy at the University of Iowa Press and trying to design, produce, and publish a book in this day and age, in the digital age, in secret is not an easy thing to do.
Oh, wow. Well, we will talk more about that part of the process in a few minutes. Zachary Turpin is with us. He is on the verge of getting his PhD from the University of Houston, and he is the one who discovered this literary treasure. Hello, Zach.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Ed was talking about when you got in touch with him and told him about this work. But let's go back before that. You are an incredible literary sleuth. What were you looking for that gave you clues that there was even a novel out there to find?
Well, I would say that I wasn't really looking for anything in particular. I think as Ed and other Whitman researchers are well aware, there's a mountain of Whitman paperwork out there, all of which is available on the Whitman Archive online, to sort of sift through or dive into at your pleasure. And the place I began was the Integrated Whitman Catalog, which is essentially an online repository of all the sort of manuscript odds and ends that are housed in different archives around the country. And the notebook that sort of got me going was called A Schoolmaster. And this notebook in particular is very interesting because it contains some what look like plot outlines for tales or maybe even more longer pieces of fiction. And the reason I was so interested in it is that it's listed as having no known connection to any of Whitman's work. And the way that this all got started is that I was fiddling around with that notebook using some of the character names that are included in it as keywords, and it led me to a literary notice in the New York Daily Times in 1852. And what's so fascinating about this notice is that it says, tomorrow in the Sunday Dispatch is a work called The Life and Adventures of Jack Ingle, which to me was fascinating because it had all the sort of trappings of what might be a Whitman work. And this is what led me to corresponding with the Library of Congress and trying to get images of this thing.
So basically, you saw a notebook with some that looked like they were ideas for a story that Whitman had jotted down. But you didn't even have any evidence at that point that he had ever written that story.
Oh, no. You know, so Whitman's known fiction period at this time was 1841 to 1848, which is already quite substantial. You know, for virtually a decade, Whitman had written fiction, but it was unclear that he had done anything beyond the year 1848.
All right. So you had this notebook with ideas, no evidence that he had ever acted on it, and then you were searching a newspaper archive for the character names? So
right.
that was a real, I guess, a stroke of good luck to even stumble across that.
I like to think so. Good luck is certainly a great term to use for what happened. But I also have to give every credit to Ed and everyone who maintains the Whitman Archive. You know, this is a place in which you can find just endless Whitman materials, both handwritten and published. And it was because of that I was able to get such easy access to these notebooks and see that they were so keyword rich. And I think his work being so keyword rich is why it was so valuable and so productive in this regard.
Interesting. All right. So you saw that notice about a serial novel being published in a newspaper, and the newspaper that it was published in, that was not something that had been digitized.
No. So the Sunday Dispatch is a pretty interesting newspaper, both for Whitmanians and for the general reading public. It was a small literary weekly that was published fairly cheaply in New York. It's quite rare today, and it's in no way digitized, which is not unusual for a lot of smaller newspapers at the time. But I guess it's hard to describe the feeling of wanting to see something that's in the Library of Congress and not being able to immediately jet off to Washington, D.C.
So how did you even get your hands on it? You had to just put in a request, right?
That's right. So my hands have never touched this newspaper. What I think is so fantastic about the Library of Congress's imaging capabilities is that even from across the country, you can get in touch with an image specialist, and they will find the newspaper in the archives that you're looking for and send you high-resolution PDFs of it. So what I had to do was request the first page of the first installment in question to see if it matched in any way these plot notes, if it had the same character names, the same general plot beginning. And I had to wait. It was a solid month before I was able to see it.
Oh, wow.
Which was quite the nail biter.
One of the longest months of your life, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was, you know, not least because that literary notice has so little real information in it. It lists the title, Life and Adventures of Jack Engel. It has a sort of very puffed up summary of what this is supposed to be. It encompasses life and law and philosophy and love and on and on and on, which sounds very, very Whitman to me. But generally, there was no indication that this was anything in particular. It was something I had to sit on and try to force myself not to read and reread, looking for, you know, any little extra clue.
Right. Well, and we should underline the fact that this was not published under Whitman's name in the paper.
No, that's right. It's published anonymously, or if you want to be technical about it, it's published as a sort of autobiography.
So by Jack Engel.
By whomever this person might be. But fortunately for me, there were some indicators that this might be something positive. Jack Engel sounds like it would be a very common name in newspapers of the period, and for whatever reason, it really isn't. Huh. There were so few hits that I got in my search results looking for that name, and one of the very few was this notice. So I thought, well, you know, that's very interesting, and I was trying very hard to restrain myself. The newspaper is also one in which he's known to have published large anonymous works before. He had several years previously published a sort of travel essay series called Letters of Traveling Bachelor. The same newspaper, same sort of length, and again anonymously. And also in the notebook that I've been looking at, there are even a few newspaper clippings that date to just before the publication of this work. So it all signs sort of pointed in the direction of Whitman, but there was nothing at all conclusive until the moment I opened that PDF.
All right. So you opened that PDF. How was that conclusive? I mean, what did that tell you? Because you just had the first page, right?
Yeah. Well, if you open the what is now the digitized version at WWQR online, or if you happen to own a copy or want to go read one, look at the very first chapter. And what you can see is that there are names that match entirely the names in the notebook, and that they're very sort of like unusual character names. There's Jack Engel, of course. There's Wigglesworth. There's Nathaniel Smith, spelled S-M-Y-T-T-H-E. And also the plot beginning matches entirely the plot of the notebook. So within seconds, I knew what I had sort of not dared hope for all month, which is that this was, in fact, and is, in fact, a lost novel by Walt Whitman.
Wow.
And for a few minutes, I was the only person in the world who had access to it.
That's incredible. And now I know that you got in touch with Ed fairly early on in this process. He also got to share some of the suspense for you. How did you start to let people know?
Well, you know, Ed is I think he's the dean of Whitman Scholarship today, so he's obviously the person to go to. And he was one of the people I went to last year with the discovery called Manly Health and Training, the sort of health and lifestyle series that Whitman had written. So I knew that were I ever to ever find something again, Ed would be the first person I would go to. And it was one of the distinctest pleasures of my life to be able to send Ed an email saying something to the effect of, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to give you a call because I have a surprise for you. I was able to tell him on the phone that we're in business again, and that we have another major text by Whitman that we get to bring to the world.
Wow. Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and we will open the novel Life and Adventures of Jack Engel, the lost novel of Walt Whitman. We'll find out what's in there and what it tells us about Walt Whitman and what it adds to his body of work. Coming up in just a moment, I'm talking with Zachary Turpin, who is a PhD graduate student at the University of Houston, the one who discovered this literary treasure. And Ed Folsom is also here, editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review. He's also the Roy J. Carver Professor of English at the University of Iowa. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about a new novel from a storied author. It's the lost novel of Walt Whitman. The novel is called Life and Adventures of Jack Engel, and it was first serialized in a newspaper in 1852. It hasn't been seen since until now. It's just been published by the University of Iowa Press. With me this hour, Zachary Turpin. He is a PhD graduate student from the University of Houston. He is the one who discovered the novel. Ed Folsom is also here. He's editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review and the Roy J. Carver Professor of English at the University of Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, Ed, how long after Zach called you and told you about this was it before you actually got to read the novel?
Well, there was another moment of suspense because when Zach got the scan of the first installment, we knew that we had the first installment of Whitman's novels. But Whitman had in the past published a novel that only appeared in one installment, and no further installments have ever been found. So we were hoping that was not the case with Jack Engel, that it was a novel that one installment came out and the paper decided, there's not much of a reaction here, we'll just let this thing go, or that Whitman gave it up at that point. But in fact, we then had to get the rest of the scans. This is a giant newspaper, one of those 19th century huge newspapers. So scanning it was not an easy task. It was an expensive task, as it turned out. And so we had to wait again for all the scans of the further installments, and opening those up when they finally came in, that was the ultimate revelation. We saw that, in fact, the entire novel was there. And at that point, Zach and my managing editor on the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review, Stefan Schoberlein, and Stephanie Blaylock, who works on the Whitman Archive and is a librarian at the University of Iowa, we all sort of dove in to transcribing the novel.
Was this an all-nighter to read through it the
first
time?
Well, it felt like an all-nighter. It went on for a couple of weeks. We all were responding to and correcting each other's transcriptions, so that it probably was something close to a record in getting this transcribed. But with everybody working together, we eventually came up with a good transcription. We had to come up with a reader's transcription because there were a lot of typos in the original, and we wanted to preserve the typos in the transcription, but we also wanted to be able to make a nice reader's copy for the University of Iowa Press to work with.
Zach, give us a summary. What's this novel about?
This novel is something that you would probably recognize as a fairly Dickensian affair. It is the story of a young man named Jack Engel who was born an orphan, essentially. He has no knowledge of his parents. He's raised by a couple of kindly New Yorkers, one of whom is a milkman and sausage vendor. And as the novel begins, he's entering into the study of law. He's in his early 20s. He is being shepherded to a law office by his adoptive father. And he immediately meets the antagonist, the bad guy in the novel, whose name, oh so subtly, is Mr. Covert. And Mr. Covert has the sort of evil, mean, the devilish aspect of somebody who's up to no good. And what we learn, though I won't spoil everything for you, is that Mr. Covert is scheming after the inheritance of someone, a young woman named Martha, whom Jack finds vaguely familiar, someone he seems to recognize from somewhere. And essentially, hijinks ensue from there. There are chases and escapes. There are revealings and secret identities unmasked. There are also meditative moments throughout the city and through, you know, the sort of natural elements of New York and Manhattan, which are highly reminiscent of Leaves of Grass, which came approximately 3 years later for the first time.
And, of course, this was billed as an autobiography. We know that it's a work of fiction, and it was published anonymously. But there are things within the novel that seem to be somewhat autobiographical about Walt Whitman, right?
That's true. Yeah, there are a number of things about this novel that correspond to Whitman's life, what we know of it or what we suspect of it. Not only was he born and raised in Long Island and then moved to Brooklyn and Manhattan, which is reflected in the novel, but also there are smaller elements of his life that seem to be reflected in the book. I'll give you a good example. So in Whitman's manuscripts, there are these odds and ends that sort of point to his general antipathy towards a particular person whom he calls Mr. Covert. And what you can gather from his manuscripts is that this person seems to have done something to his father's business when Whitman was around the age of five. His father was a carpenter and a real estate developer, which is what Whitman was doing as he wrote this novel as well. In the early 1850s, to make ends meet, he was, besides writing some journalism, developing properties in Brooklyn. And what the novel suggests is that whoever this person was essentially contracted his father's services to build a house while kind of assuring him that he need not build it according to the contractual deadline, that, you know, that don't worry about the date, that this is something that will work out in time. And in the novel, what happens is the day that the date passes, the police come and cordon off the house and say that this is now the owner's who will have to pay nothing for it. So it seems to suggest that, though this is unclear, that somebody may have essentially screwed his father over real estate. And this is something that permanently hurt the Whitman family, and that Whitman seems to have never forgotten, much less forgiven.
All right. So it does give you some clues into his life. Now, reading the novel, Walt Whitman, of course, is best known as a poet, and he also sort of famously disavowed anything he wrote before Leaves of Grass, his iconic work. So reading the novel, what does it tell you about Walt Whitman as a writer? And Ed, I'll let you take a first shot at that.
Well, I think the most important aspect of this discovery is that it's a late piece of Whitman fiction. As Zach mentioned before, up to this discovery, we had always assumed that Whitman actually stopped writing fiction in the late 1840s. 1848 was the last known publication of a short story.
And Leaves of Grass was published in 1855.
Correct.
So you sort of thought that was the turning point.
Exactly. Okay. There was a convenient 7-year break during which Whitman began publishing a much more radical, politically charged kind of poetry than the early sentimental, rhymed, metered verse he'd published in the 1840s. He began publishing that new kind of verse in 1850, and it looked like a pretty straight line toward Leaves of Grass. But the fact that we now have a novel that he wrote in 1852, published in 1852, at the time he was already working on the poems that would become Leaves of Grass, begins to mingle the fiction and the poetry in a way that we never knew happened. And I think this novel lends itself particularly because of the timing to a kind of analysis that says, well, you know, where do we see the beginnings of Leaves of Grass? Where do we see this the fiction beginning to bleed into the poetry? At the time, Whitman in his notebooks was writing the oftentimes entire lines and certainly many of the ideas that would become the central themes of Leaves of Grass. And in his notebooks, you can see him struggling with what genre this new work he was going to try to accomplish, what genre it would eventually take its form in. So he would write at a key point as he's thinking about something that's going to become There Was a Child Went Forth, a poem in Leaves of Grass. He actually writes in his notebook a novel, a spiritual novel, a play, a poem. He's not sure what it's going to appear as. And I think at this point in his life, he's wondering how can fiction accomplish my goals, and how can poetry accomplish my goals, and how can this new thing that a lot of people, when they first read Leaves of Grass, wouldn't even call poetry.
Right.
How can this new kind of form begin to accomplish the kind of thing I want to accomplish?
So, and nice of him to think on paper, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed.
Zach, anything you want to add to that? And in just a minute, Ed is going to read us a little bit from the novel so we can all get a taste of it. But what do you think we can learn about Whitman from reading this?
You know, I concur wholeheartedly with Ed. You know, I think one thing that's very important to remember about Leaves of Grass, as Ed just said, is that it is not even put forward as poetry until the second edition in 1856. While he refers to them as songs or poems within the text itself, it isn't listed on the title page as Leaves of Grass, a collection of poems, or Leaves of Grass, verses on nature. It's simply Leaves of Grass. And this radical prose poetics that Ed is referring to really doesn't give itself away as prose or poetry as such. And you can see in Whitman's manuscripts, as Ed said, that Whitman is groping for a form that is capacious enough to express these emotions that he's feeling and putting down on paper. I also think that what's so fascinating about this novel, as Ed said, is that it's something of a sort of missing link in Whitman's literary career, but it also suggests, as do some other pieces of manuscript, that Whitman may have continued to write one or more novels of which we're currently unaware. So there may be an entire early novelistic career out there somewhere for enterprising researchers to locate.
Enterprising researchers like yourself.
Yeah.
Well, Ed, would you read us a little bit? This is from fairly early in the novel, so it gives us an idea of Whitman's gift for characterization, really building a character study.
Yeah, this is the from Chapter 2, where Whitman first describes the man who would become his adoptive father, Ephraim Foster, a kind of foster father for Whitman. And it captures something about the economy with which Whitman can quickly sketch in a character and bring a character to life. It also has a nice echo of or anticipation of Manly Health and Training, where Whitman talks about America's love of particular kinds of food. Among the earliest customers of Ephraim Foster, there came one morning a little white-headed boy, neither handsome nor ugly. Ephraim kept a shop in one of the thoroughfares that crossed Grand Street east of Bowery. He sold milk, eggs, and sundry etceteras, in winter adding to his vocations those of a purveyor of pork and sausage meat, which is a driving and a thriving trade hereabout in cold weather. Fair America rivals ancient Greece in its love of pork. At the proper season, you may see, thickly set through the streets, the places for furnishing this favorite winter eating, beautiful red and white slices, mighty hams, either fresh or smoked, sides and forequarters, and at intervals a grinning head with fat cheeks and ears erect. Still more preferable to some is the powerfully spiced sausage meat or the jelly-like head cheese. In the preparation of the latter articles, the worthy Ephraim always did wonders, for folks had confidence in him, which is a great deal to bestow on a sausage vendor. However, he deserved it all. He deserved more. He was one of the best fellows that ever lived. People said now and then that he would never set the North River afire, and yet Foster jogged along, even in his pecuniary affairs, faster and steadier than some who had the reputation of much superior cunning. He was, without thinking of it at all, constitutionally kind, liberal, and unselfish. It was in a humble way, to be sure, but nonetheless credit for that. He had a knack of making mistakes against his own interest, giving the customer the odd pennies and never gouging in weight or measure.
That's Ed Folsom reading from the lost novel of Walt Whitman, Life and Adventures of Jack Ingle. Ed Folsom is editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review. Zachary Turpin is a PhD graduate student at the University of Houston. He's the one who discovered this lost novel. In your opinion, just as a reader, Ed, is this a good book?
Well, I think it is a good book. I've been asked if I find this just essentially as a novel a really good novel, and it's a difficult question to answer because I think we always think of novels in their historical and contextual and critical settings, so that any novel we now consider a great American novel, Scarlet Letter, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Moby Dick, they're all novels that we've been familiar with for a long time. People have written about them. People have read them, talked about them, discussed them. Classes have dealt with them. Critical industries have been built on them. So what makes it interesting is to take a novel that now just appears out of nowhere after 165 years. Nobody has read this novel. Nobody has talked about it. Nobody has thought about it in its historical contexts. So Whitman wrote one other novel back in 1842, 10 years before this, one other that we know of. And it has been talked about and known about for most of the years since Whitman's death. And, it's been dismissed by many, but in recent years has been looked at more and more as an important early indication of a lot of things Whitman would be developing in Leaves of Grass. And I think this novel, as we teach it, think about it, talk about it, I think it's already happening, is going to be a more and more important part of Whitman's development. I don't think it'll ever be looked at as a great novel, but I think it probably will be looked at as one of the most accomplished pieces of Whitman's fiction.
Well, and we'll talk about some of the clues that you can see in the novel to his later writings in a moment. We're coming up on a break, but Zach, what do you think? A good read?
Oh, yeah. I think this is really one of the most exciting and fascinating things that Whitman ever wrote. Not only is it something of a page-turner, but it's quite funny in parts, too, and not a little beautiful, as you'll find after the break.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Zachary Turpin. He is a PhD graduate student at the University of Houston. He discovered the lost novel of Walt Whitman. Ed Folsom is here, editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review and the Roy J. Carver Professor of English at the University of Iowa. The novel has just been published by the University of Iowa Press. It's called Life and Adventures of Jack Ingle. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the lost novel of Walt Whitman. It's called Life and Adventures of Jack Ingle. It has just been published by University of Iowa Press, and this is the first time people can read it since it was serialized in a newspaper in 1852. With me this hour, Zach Turpin. He is a PhD graduate student at the University of Houston. He's the one who discovered this literary treasure. Also, Ed Folsom is here. He's editor of the Walt Whitman Quarterly Review and the Roy J. Carver Professor of English at the University of Iowa. And I want to hear a little bit more from this novel, because you talked about how there are clues in the novel that sort of lead you to or give you an insight into Whitman as he's developing into the writer that would publish this iconic work, Leaves of Grass. And one of the parts of the book that really gives you those clues is in chapter 19. And Ed's going to read it. Zach, why don't I give you a chance to talk about it a little bit before Ed reads it? This period in chapter 19, a scene in a cemetery. What's going on here?
Sure. So the titular character, Jack Ingle, has essentially leapt out of the narrative. The narrative comes to a complete halt so that he can wander Trinity Churchyard, which is at the southern tip of Manhattan. It's still there today. And he reads inscriptions on gravestones, which are also still there today, and meditates on life and death and renewal and nature, as you'll hear from Ed.
All right, Ed.
Yeah, and I'd just add to what Zach said that what I love about this particular section, as Zach noted, is the plot comes to a dead stop, and it comes to a dead stop as Jack is wandering among grave plots, and he's thinking about the plots of all the people's lives that have ended here in the cemetery. I spent the rest of that pleasant golden forenoon, one of the finest days of our American autumn, wandering slowly through the Trinity graveyard. I felt in the humor, serious, without deep sadness, and I went from spot to spot and sometimes copied the inscriptions. Long, rank grass covered my face. Over me was the verdure, touched with brown of trees nourished from the decay of the bodies of men. The tombstone nearest me held this inscription, James M. Baldwin, aged 22 years, wounded on Lake Champlain. By the date of the time of his wound and also that of his death, both of which were given on the stone, I knew that the latter took place about a year after the first. Here, then, lay one of the Republic's faithful children, faithful to death. Was it? For I felt in a musing vein, hard for him to die? Hung round about his prospects a gay-colored future? 22. That was my own age. And of death, I shuddered instinctively at the thought. For I felt that life, matter of fact as it was and is in reality, I felt that to me it opened enjoyment and pleasure on every side. I was very happy in my friends, happy in having Ephraim and Violet and Tom and Martha and Inez, every one of them. I was happy that I lived in this glorious New York, where, if one goes without activity and enjoyment, it must be his own fault in the main. Truly, life is sweet to the young man. Such bounding and swelling capacities for joy reside within him, and such ambitious yearnings. Health and unfettered spirits are his staff and mantle. He learns unthinkingly to love, that glorious privilege of youth. Out of the tiny fractions of his experience, he builds beautiful imaginings and confidently looks for the future to realize them. And then he is so sure of those future years. Was not probably such the spirit of the young man whose grave I now sat on? The shroud and the coffin for him? Alas, so it was ordained. For nearly a year, fever burned his blood, and sharp pains racked him, and then came the dismissal of oblivion.
That's Ed Folsom reading from Life and Adventures of Jack Engle, the lost novel of Walt Whitman. And both of you have said that you hear the Whitman that wrote Leaves of Grass in this passage. Zach, what do you hear in this that makes you think, yes, this is the Whitman we know and love?
I think this chapter stood out to everyone immediately. The transcription team that Ed mentioned before, Ed, me, Stefan, and Stephanie, all stopped at this chapter and really had to take pause at the elements that match Leaves of Grass so well. What I hear are the moments in which not only is Whitman thinking about the grass and the verdure as something of a metaphor for rebirth and renewal, you know, in Leaves of Grass, he thinks of grass not only as the handkerchief of the Lord, not only as a sort of riddle or hieroglyphic, but he also calls it the uncut hair of graves. So not only do I hear that, but I hear the meditations that would come to be a part of Leaves of Grass in subsequent editions. For example, in the second edition of Leaves of Grass, published in 1856, he includes a poem called Sundown Poem, which would later be retitled Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. And in that poem, he meditates on the generations that came before, and he then speaks to the reader as someone who is coming after him. And he says, even though hundreds of years have passed and generations after generation, it's nothing. I am here with you now. This book in your hands is me. And that sense that there both time has passed and generations have come and gone, but also that we all coexist, is right there in this chapter.
And Whitman's confidence that his work would be read many generations hence is striking.
He's very confident in his poetry.
That really is. It is Whitman's faith. It's what he had instead of religious faith. It really was his religious faith that there would be generations hence that would be sentient, alive, able to read his work.
And wanting to read his work, which he was right, which is pretty incredible. Ed, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'd just say that what really struck me about this chapter is that I can feel in Whitman's writing here as he's nearing the end of the novel and nearing the end of his installment writing. Most novelists who wrote serialized novels were writing it as it was being published. And I can sense in this chapter Whitman coming to the end of plots, coming to the end of the notion that telling a plot was the best way to get at the particular aspects of experience that he wanted to emphasize and would emphasize in Leaves of Grass. At the end of that chapter, he's thinking again about the coffins that lie just, he says, 6 feet below where I stood and enclosed the ashes of like young men. And what really gets his attention at that point is now not so much those grave plots, those little inscriptions on the stone that reduce life to a few odd little facts, but rather the sounds he hears just outside the cemetery. At the very end of the chapter, he talks about listening to the crowds that are walking by just outside the walls, oblivious to these grave plots just a few feet away. And he says, but onward rolled the broad, bright current and troubled themselves not yet with gloomy thoughts. And this is the Whitman that is going to emerge in Song of Myself and Leaves of Grass, the Whitman that's looking always for the ever-renewing moment of life. There are going to be endless thousands of people that are passing through and die, but there will always be, in any moment of now, endless thousands alive.
Ed, I know that you have devoted your career to the study of Walt Whitman. I mean, many of us encountered Leaves of Grass, read it. Many love it. It's still read today. But Whitman clearly looms larger than most of us realize. Why? What makes Walt Whitman such an important figure, in your opinion, even today in 2017?
I'm most struck, I guess, by how I first came to study Whitman, which was really through my reading of 20th century and contemporary American poetry. Every American poet I read, I discovered, at some key point in his or her career, would have to come to grips with Walt Whitman. Whitman was such an overwhelming presence in American poetry. And I think part of it's because of what we've been talking about, that he had this faith. He wrote a poetry that was addressed to the future, that created a character named you, Y-O-U, that would be you, every individual reader and all readers in the future. You always get this very unsettling sense. No other poet has ever accomplished it. A sense that you is speaking intimately to you, Charity, reading this book right now, and also you, everybody, all of you, strangers around the world. It's that promiscuous second person pronoun in English that no other language has, that we use the same pronoun, the same word to address our most intimate lover and a perfect stranger. They're both you. In every other language, you distinguish between strangers and formal occasions and plurals and singulars. But in English, it's all one word. It's this very promiscuous word. And Whitman wrote an entire poetry based on that ability to slip from the personal to the impersonal, from the single close person to the strangers around the world. And his poetry has spoken again and again to so many people. So Langston Hughes and Hart Crane and Allen Ginsberg and Robert Creeley and endless numbers of poets, Yusef Komunyakaa, Jory Graham, on and on and on, all respond to Whitman at key points, either encountering him in a poem that they write, talking back to him quite literally. So you've asked me about this, Walt. Let me tell you what things are like today. It's a remarkable phenomenon, and I don't think any other author has generated the kind of response, incredibly intense, ongoing response to his or her work that Whitman has done.
And not just traditional literary response. I mean, you see in popular culture, you see echoes of Whitman, right?
Oh, absolutely. Everywhere.
Give me some examples.
Well, you know, I think everybody knows in movies like Dead Poets Society, where Whitman probably internationally through that movie came once again to be generally known. Lots of people have been fanatics of Breaking Bad, and you can't follow the television series Breaking Bad without beginning to really wonder about what role Whitman is playing in there, because he keeps...
You can't? Okay. Explain that to me.
He keeps being quoted, and the final key scene is the reading of Leaves of Grass at a key moment.
And you even think the character name Walter White is an echo of Walt Whitman.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, It's amazing how often he appears. Hundreds of musicians have set his work to music, including some of the greatest American musicians and architects like Frank Lloyd Wright have been tremendously influenced by Whitman as well. I think of Michael Cunningham. the novelist who has a book called Specimen Days that are three novellas about Walt Whitman. Michael told me once that he now thinks of Whitman more as a utility than an author. That is, people in the culture tap into Whitman as they tap into electricity or water or nuclear energy. There's no good or bad involved. It's just that he's there, always a generative force that can be tapped into and reused again and again to create something new.
Zachary, your skill and gift for research and digging through archives has caused lightning to strike twice. Do you think that there's more to discover out there from what Walt Whitman was writing?
I do. You know, I like to think that it's not wishful thinking because I've spent a lot of time with Whitman's manuscripts in digital form, and there's every indication that there may be more. And, you know, sometimes I like to think that I get some of this eternal optimism from Whitman himself. I think that often scholars in a particular field or of a particular author tend to get their ethos from that author. And everyone in the field of Whitman studies from Ed on down is so open-armed and generous and optimistic because that's the way Whitman was. So I have to give every credit both to Ed and to Whitman for keeping things so positive. And, you know, I also think that one of the reasons that Whitman is still so popular today, to bounce off of Ed, although he said it best, is that Whitman has that eternal optimism and faith in diversity. You know, he says that the Americans of all nations at any time upon the earth have probably the fullest poetical nature. And he says that the United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem. And I think that's something that's important to keep in mind even today.
So are you continuing your search? I understand you have a growing family. You have a PhD to finish getting. Are you still staying up nights searching for clues about Walt Whitman?
I am. You know, I won't pathologize myself any longer because I think this is a really productive and fascinating way to spend one's time. But yeah, I never stop. And I have a few leads that I'm currently pursuing right now that point towards the Library of Congress and other archives. So it's an exciting time to be a Whitman scholar.
And what do you want people who read this novel to take away from it, Zach, now that you've brought this to the world?
You know, there's so much you could take away from it. I think one of the things that really encourages me is something that occurred to me in the first few minutes that I was reading the first page of this novel, and that's that there is so when Whitman was writing this, he was 33, and I'm 33, and it struck me that this is a person who I can relate to, somebody who is in his early 30s, and I think as many Americans experience, there's a time in one's 30s when you sort of question who you will be and what your calling is on this earth and how you're going to express yourself and what you're going to do both for the country now and for future generations.
So this was a real moment of discovery for Walt Whitman. Zachary Turpin, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Zachary Turpin is a PhD graduate student from the University of Houston. Ed Folsom, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Charity.